Hello, everybody, and welcome to Reason Town, episode 11. We're getting into the double digits now.
That's right.
And today we're calling this episode Potpourri because we got a lot of stuff, not one central theme, a lot of things to talk about. But before we talk about anything, we want to let you know that our hosting is sponsored by TylerMcGinnis.com, the linear course-based approach to learning web technologies. You can go there and learn about React and all kinds of web stuff. Thank you, Tyler. We really appreciate it. Also sponsored by the company I work for, Day One, whom I love. And you can look up more about Day One on the App Store for iOS or just on Google. Did you want to plug Khan Academy, Jared, while you're here?
Yeah. So I work for Khan Academy, online learning nonprofit. And they're great, too.
I'll make a plug for you, too, because you guys just released an app for kids' education.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
Featured on the App Store, and I downloaded it for my four-year-old, and she loves it.
Mm-hmm.
She loves it.
And everything we make is free.
Which is amazing. That is, I don't even know how that works with money, because you do get paid, right? Like
I personally get paid, yeah. it's great. I mean, it's lots of big philanthropy donations. And then some corporate partnership things.
Way cool. At some point, like, you could get enough donations to make some amount of money off of, like, interest, right, in the bank. And maybe, like, probably not enough to perpetuate, though.
I mean, people have talked about doing an endowment. Like, I mean, Harvard has an endowment that is just, like, billions of dollars such yeah. that they can live off the interest. That would be cool.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
So if there's an angel endower.
Right.
There.
If somebody's got $1 billion that they want to give to Khan Academy, would not turn it down.
Be great. All right. So let's get to the news section. We got a lot of news today.
Yeah. First up, I'm excited about this. The State of Reason survey just got started end of last week, and we have almost 300 respondents so far. It'll be going for another couple of weeks. If you haven't seen it, please take it. Even if you haven't started using Reason yet, we would love to get your input on why you haven't started using it, what you like about it, what you don't, and what we can do to both make the language better and the community better, more inclusive.
And yeah, so I've kind of wondered for a while what the reason is behind doing these State of X surveys. But it seems that it really helps the people who are making the language to better suit the needs of the people who they're targeting, right? So that's one reason.
Yeah, that's one reason. Also on there, there's a question about what things would you like to hear on the ReasonTown podcast.
Mm-hmm, that's
so we can use that to kind of figure out what our episode should be about. There's a question about what would you like to see at a Reason conference? So kind of choosing how to best meet the needs of the user base.
Perfect. So go take that survey. Even if you don't use Reason, we want to know from you, like Jared was saying, why. Go hit the response on that survey and tell us why you're not using Reason, or, you know, what the challenges are, et cetera.
Yep.
So that's great. That's super. Next up is the BuckleScript 4.0 release.
Yeah.
That's a major version. Mm-hmm. It went from 3x to 4.0. So the interesting thing here is that the major new version here is a built-in hot reloading development server for the front end. So if you're doing, I'm guessing many people are doing front end. I'm probably one of the weirdos doing not front end as much with this.
Yeah.
But that's cool because they kind of mock the node module loader. They'll watch the file system, and whenever a recompile happens, they'll trigger a reload in the browser.
Yeah.
And this is all without Webpack. The idea is to get up and running quickly, get up developing quickly. You'll still need Webpack to ship because they're not pretending to be uh-huh. Webpack. Like, they're not going to build any compiled assets or do any splitting or any bundling for you. But it's there for getting started, which is cool.
Yeah, because previously the Hello World story was, so get BuckleScript, also you'll need Webpack, and here's a Webpack config. And it just gets rid of that extra step.
Very cool.
The other cool thing about this release is optionals are more efficient and make more sense. So if there's a none in your code, it shows up as a null
in your compiled output
in JavaScript.
Yeah.
And if there's a sum with a value in it, then in JavaScript it's just the value. You don't have to, like, get the first element of the array or any weird things like that.
Right. So that's because if you looked at your compiled output for your code before 4.0, then none was a zero.
Right.
And then a sum was an array with one element of the value that it had in it.
Yeah.
Which just isn't super readable, right? So
yeah,
that's cool. Way to go. Thank you, BuckleScript people, for doing that. We really appreciate it. And lots of hard work there. And this is accompanied also, I just said this. This is accompanied by a reason 3.3.2 or 3.3.3 now release. So we got some new syntax. They changed the FastPipe from vertical bar dot. FastPipe being like the pizza, like the right pizza, the vertical bar with the right arrow, used for taking everything on the left and putting it into the right. We changed that from, FastPipe is the opposite. Takes everything on the left and puts it in the first argument of the function on the right.
Right.
So the FastPipe syntax has changed from vertical bar dot to horizontal bar.
To skinny arrow.
Yeah, skinny arrow. That's a better way to say it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's to be called with no white space around it. Which is right. Interesting.
Yeah.
So
so it looks almost like an attribute lookup
right.
from PHP or from C maybe. And so it kind of makes it feel like you're almost doing object oriented. In JavaScript you have object.x.y.z calling those functions and stuff. And now in Reason there's a similar look to it.
Which is nice for mental flow.
Yeah.
And I forgot to write it in the notes, but I actually wrote a blog post on this.
Yeah, it was good.
Oh, thanks for reading it. And so I'll put that in the show notes too. And so if you're still not straight on what we're talking about, there's some more information there. And then there's some Reason React things in this release, some better error messages.
Right.
And other important but less noticeable changes.
Yeah, lots of things under the hood. Fixing various formatting bugs, making reformat preserve more white space, do nice things like that.
So thanks to the team for shipping that out too. We really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Now we got a couple of cool announcements, a couple of cool tools.
Yeah, some picks here.
First one is sketch.sh, sketch.sh, released by Koa. And I'm not going to try to say your last name, Koa, because I don't know how to pronounce it. But this is a cool tool that's an in-browser REPL.
That's
for,
right.
For Reason, but it's not like BuckleScript.
That's right. It is taking the OCaml top level, the REPL that comes with OCaml, and putting it on the web in JavaScript. He just recently added the OCaml syntax support as well. Rapid development over the past couple of weeks. Very cool project that you should definitely keep an eye on, especially if you just want to do one-off things. There's the Try Reason playground, but this is more in the spirit of an IPython notebook.
Yeah.
Or one of those things where you can have, some text and then some code and then evaluate it in line and then keep iterating on that.
And he's seeking contributions if you're interested in helping out. I haven't used it a whole ton yet because I do a lot. I don't do a lot of stuff that doesn't involve BuckleScript.
Yeah.
But where would you find this useful without the need for BuckleScript? Just in doing pure Reason things?
Definitely trying one-off things. It also does the shareable URL thing. So if you're helping somebody out in the Discord channel and you want to show them, this is how you would do it, you can just link to that kind of thing.
So you have full access to the type system, full access to the built-in data structures. Belt, I'm guessing, is part of BuckleScript, so you wouldn't have that.
I don't know if it ships with Belt. That's a good question, because they have made Belt native compatible.
Okay.
As well.
So it might be there.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing the OCaml standard library is there because it's OCaml. So.
Mm-hmm.
So super sweet. Thank you, Koa, for doing that.
Yeah.
And now?
And the other pick is Rebolt. The call stack folks who are very big in the React Native world, they run reactnative.eu and do consulting for React Native development and have done a ton of contribution to React Native itself. And lots of they've been helping get more insight into how React Native has changed, all these kind of things. Anyway, they're excited about Reason. And so they made a new binding library for Reason and React Native. That's different than BS React Native, which is the one that has existed before. And they're experimenting on how can we make React Native development really, really jive with Reason. So definitely take a look at that.
The Reason way.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Thanks, folks. That's our news.
Yeah.
If we miss anything, we're sorry. If you did something cool, we didn't pick it, we apologize.
Yeah.
You could poke us on Twitter. You can poke us on Discord and say, hey, will you talk about my thing?
Right. Feel free.
Yeah. And so let's get to the potpourri. Let's get to the good smelling stuff of the podcast.
Into the meat of it.
I want you to tell me about this Lisp that I saw you talking about on Twitter.
Right. So, one of the things that actually was talked about in the early days of Reason was, wouldn't it be cool if anyone could have their own custom syntax that they used to develop Reason?
You mean to develop in Reason?
To write Reason code.
Okay.
And it kind of makes sense. You're starting with a language, you're writing a new syntax, and everybody has opinions about syntax. So what if we could make it flexible enough that anyone could bring their own syntax, and it would all compile down to the same code, and somehow be interoperable? And there are lots of little logistical things to work out with how do editors work and how do build tools work and all this stuff. But it's a thing that has kind of been talked about on and off. And a couple of years ago, I wanted to make a Swifty syntax, and I was interested in grammar generators, parser generators. And so I wrote a thing, and then about a month ago, somebody was like, oh, I wish I had a Lisp version of Reason. I really like Clojure, or I really like Common Lisp or Racket or whatever it is, but Reason is a cool, a cool project. Wouldn't it be awesome to have a Lisp syntax? And Sean Grove, who was really into ClojureScript and Clojure for a while, has been bugging me about this. He pinged me on Twitter and was like, hey, when are you going to get this done? And so I decided to just kind of bang it out and see how far I got. And so I managed to get a working parser going that covers nearly all of the syntax of Reason. And I made an example project in it. And because I was working on an editor plugin at the same time, I was able to just kind of make that work too. So you get all the syntax highlighting benefits and, hover for type and a bunch of fun things.
That is insane. So I have a few questions about this, because I thought Reason was a syntax on top of OCaml.
Yeah.
Is this also just an alternative syntax on top of OCaml, or is this a syntax on top of Reason on top of OCaml?
It's just an alternative syntax on top of OCaml.
Okay, so it's still using OCaml's built-in AST.
All the same underlying things.
This is a sibling to Reason. You wouldn't even have to call it Reason, right?
Right.
Like, does it use anything Reason specific?
It's optimized for BuckleScript, and it uses the BuckleScript toolchain. And so I call it Reason Lisp because, the Reason community is the one that is interested in alternative syntaxes for OCaml.
Okay, so this is like Reason's sibling language.
That's right.
Uses the same tools for going to Java, but this is not Reason. But
right.
Well, that's really interesting. So why did you have to write a parser? Oh, of course you have to write a parser because the back end is the thing that's pluggable, right?
That's right.
You just have to generate the AST. So you had to get a parser that would parse the Lisp and then go to the AST.
Yeah.
Wow. And you're just like, this is just something you just did quick?
Well, so I had done the hard work a couple of years ago when I made a parser generator that basically you can just write out the grammar of, I want an open paren, and then I want if, and then any expression, and I'll tell you what an expression looks like, and here are the different ways that an expression can be shaped. And so I did that, and so most of the work was done, and I just had to make a Lisp grammar and do some tweaking.
So I'm curious as to why you wrote your own parser generator, because I was looking into this a while back too, and there are a number of kind of academic level pre-existing parser generators. Is this an exercise you wanted to do on your own, or what?
This is kind of into the weeds, but
it's okay. I think we're getting in the weeds today.
Right.
It's kind of a weedy podcast today.
The parser generators that I saw, there are a couple of quite popular ones for OCaml. Reason actually uses Meneer, which is a parser generator for OCaml. And they do what is called, they have, it's not non-deterministic, but when there's, for example, an expression and there are seven different ways, things that could be an expression, there could be a string, or there could be a function call, or there could be, you know, several other things. The grammar says, I will check all of these at once, and then if there are two that could work, I will randomly pick one.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Or I will arbitrarily pick one, and you don't get to know which one.
Okay.
But I will complain. You know, I'll throw up a warning while you're developing or whatever. And so when you're developing a grammar, you have to be very careful not to get these ambiguities. And sometimes they can be really annoying to hash them out and make them work. And so I wanted a parser generator that was just, you check the first option. If it doesn't work, you check the second one, and on and on and on. And it's using the PackRat parser format or algorithm, which is, somebody wrote a paper and called it PackRat.
Okay.
So that was one reason. I also wanted it to be written in Reason, and I wanted the parser generated code to be Reason so that I could edit it better. And if you're going to use Meneer, you're writing OCaml. And it's harder for me to read OCaml.
There you go.
And you know, Meneer was written a long time ago. And so it has some interesting, like I wanted to take advantage of PPX, transforms for actually defining the grammar so that you get all the syntax highlighting, all the, you know, IDE features while you're developing the grammar. Again, Meneer has its own custom file format that doesn't really work with editor plugins. There were kind of a bunch of different things. And I had made a parser generator for Python back in college because I was taking a class about something.
Yeah.
So I wanted to redo it in Reason, see if I could get a lot faster and that kind of thing.
Well, awesome. So is that the kind of thing that if someone's interested in using it, they could contact you and,
yeah,
and get it?
Yeah, totally.
Is it usable state by other people?
I put some effort into writing up documentation and that kind of thing.
Cool.
So if you're interested in making new grammars, if you want to make a Reason that looks like C#, then, you know, maybe you could do that.
So now I'm curious about this because I do wonder, do you think that it will fragment the community to have people doing all these different grammars all the time?
So currently the barrier is high enough, that I don't think, I mean, it's not a straightforward thing necessarily. You have to kind of, okay. I mean, I tried to make Reason Lisp relatively easy to use, but I had to bake it into the VS Code plugin to be like, I will now recognize a .rel
okay.
Extension.
Okay.
And I think if we were going to go all in and say, yeah, we can have a ton of different grammars coexisting, we'd need a more, a better solution. Maybe all of them on disk would look like, you know, standard Reason, but then in your editor, it would be the syntax that you
want. Sure.
Work.
Yeah. That'd be interesting. It'd also be interesting to have like a, cause the big, like the main problem for learning that I see is in documentation,
right,
and stuff, because we already have this problem. Like I'll go to look at the guts of a library. This isn't documentation, obviously, but I'll go to look at the guts of the library, and if it's written in OCaml, I have a much harder time understanding what's going on.
Totally.
Versus the Reason syntax. So, I'm curious to know, like, now what if somebody, if people pick up Reason Lisp, now I have three syntaxes to try to parse when I'm looking through. I guess that's just a cost to having an ecosystem that's flexible like that.
Right. And there's Reason Tools, which is a Chrome extension that will... you can just select any OCaml code on a page and say, turn this into Reason for me, and it'll do it.
Which is cool.
So maybe if we had a bunch of different syntaxes, there would be a way to say, these are the ones that exist. I don't know. It's certainly, you know, not going to be happening anytime soon, but something to think about.
It's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
So with the Reason Lisp, is this kind of just like a play thing, or are you expecting people to... Lisp lovers to go and start using it, and if they did, would you support it?
It was totally a side project. That, you know, if somebody is excited about it and wants to start using it, then
you can hand it off to them.
I'll give some level of support, but certainly not doing lots of active development on it.
So Sean, get ready to take over a new project alongside your Y Combinator startup that you're doing, because you have time, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. Anything else about the Lisp before we move on?
No, let's move on to you have some more learnings about server-side reason.
Yeah, more server-side stuff.
Tell us about it.
So server-side Express is pretty cool. The bindings for Express in Reason are pretty sweet.
Cool.
The Express server. But here's what I'm doing. So I'm not going to go through the whole decision process because I don't even know what we were talking about before on the podcast. But I am writing a service that is going to be heavily database-based.
Right.
A sync service for storing data, checking to see if it's changed from clients, et cetera. And my plan was to move to Postgres as a data store.
Uh-huh.
And I had done a bunch of writing SQL and Reason to interface with Postgres and to expose APIs. And then one day I was doing some more research and looking at maybe I could use a more established framework like Loopback, which Loopback is pretty neat. There's a new version coming out and it's built on top of Express. It's kind of the Rails model where you generate your models and it generates a bunch of code for you.
Cool.
Like you would declaratively basically say this is what my model looks like, and it generates full CRUD APIs for it and database models.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, maybe that could save me some time because my new service, the way I've designed the new sync service is pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm writing facades over our old, more complex APIs to interface with the new stuff. And I was like, it would be great to save some time and get that code that's CRUD-ish, that's generatable, taken care of.
Uh-huh.
So I started looking at different options and I found a very cool tool. I've talked about Prisma before on here. Prisma lets you take your GraphQL APIs and generate a backend, which is really sweet. Here's another tool that goes the opposite way, which lets you take your backend and expose your backend as a GraphQL API.
Okay.
There's this tool called PostgreSQL, which is funny to say, but PostgreSQL, which is developed by one guy who's been a consultant for Postgres for years and is a JavaScript guy for years.
Okay.
And so he runs this thing and sells it on the side. So it is free if you are using it in development. And he accepts donations, but if you're going to use it as a big company, it's expected.
There's a license.
You'd pay. Yeah.
Okay.
It's actually plugins that he sells.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, if you want these more premium features and
cool,
pay $100 a month, but it also says also just support the project,
right,
you know,
right.
Which makes sense. Like if you're making money with it, you should help support it.
And if you want it to continue to exist and,
yes,
you know.
So here's the thing. I was like, yeah, these things are always cool, but what if it just supports the most basic happy case and doesn't do all of the things I needed to do? I started to press on it. This is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm a fan of using Postgres to its full extent in the sense of not abstracting over your database with an ORM where you say what if I want to switch from Postgres to MySQL, I just want to be able to, you know, change the URL and have it work, which is the idea of some ORMs.
Right.
I haven't ever heard if anyone has ever successfully done that, because a lot of ORMs tend to be leaky, I think.
Right. Yeah.
And a lot of people want to use the advantage of the database itself. So this kind of embraces that. It says use your database to its full extent. And here's what's really neat. So this Postgres tool detects your schema, exposes all of the appropriate GraphQL types for reads, for your table, you're like, okay, I've got a journals table. It exposes the journal object for reading. Then it also does the mutations.
Okay.
So it does a different type for the mutations. And then it also detects your relations between the tables.
Oh, nice.
And hooks up all of the GraphQL relations there. And then at the application layer, so this PostgreSQL tool, you can use it directly as an Express middleware. Just plug it right
nice.
In. You've got a GraphQL API. And you can use database comments on tables and fields to hide things and disallow certain actions from your API, which
nice.
Is sweet. So when someone's inserting a record, I can say they can't insert the ID. They can't make up their own ID. I get to make that for them, right? So that I can hide that. But here's what's even cooler. you can just use row level security in Postgres directly.
Okay.
To take care of all of your like user protection and multi-tenancy stuff. So like I've got a bunch of people who have journal data.
Yeah.
And I don't want any of them to be able to see each other's journal data.
Right.
And previously in our other servers, we would have to have an application layer logic that would, when you sent in a request, it would check your user. And then if it would say, are you trying to access a journal? Okay. Make sure that the journals you've retrieved are only belong to you.
Right.
Postgres has this functionality built in where now when I connect to the database, I actually set the user ID on the session. And
right.
There's row-level rules that I've written onto the tables that say only the user who owns this data can access it. And so to those requests where that user ID is set on the query, no data even exists in the database except for the data that belongs to them. And that's at the database level. So that's way faster than the round trips from the application to the database. And then PostgreSQL also, it takes your GraphQL query and it compiles it to one giant SQL statement. So there's one round trip to the database.
Nice.
I'm pretty stoked about this. Like, this is super cool.
So the row-level security rules, are they written in JavaScript? What are they? Is there some special syntax?
So that's what's interesting about Postgres is there's a whole lot of like application logic you can do.
Okay.
That's Postgres. You can define functions in Postgres you can define functions that run like in reaction to a table changing. You can define functions that just sit there. And using PostgreSQL, you can actually expose those functions as mutations, not just the data model. So like one example they gave is if you want to have a user sign up, you actually write the function for hashing the user's password and storing it in the right places and making multiple records. You write that all as a Postgres function. Then you expose that function as a mutation that says create user, which is super cool.
Wow.
And then Postgres itself supports multiple languages. So there's a built-in one called PLPGSQL.
Okay.
Which is what I use because it's just like the default and it's
right.
SQL and it's hard to read, but I want to learn SQL better. Anyway, you can run JavaScript. There's
okay.
Somebody wrote an extension that lets you write JavaScript and evaluate it. They run some VM and then they'll evaluate the code. I have yet to look into that deeper because I don't know like what APIs you have access to.
Sure.
That's what I would be interested to know. But syntax-wise, you can do JavaScript. There's also a built-in, I believe, is Python as well.
Oh, cool.
So you can do Python, you can do JavaScript.
That's nice.
Yeah. So I'm geeking out about this. And like I've already used the functions that run in reaction to data updating to help have like faster application logic where if like a user updates their entry, it marks their journal as it being updated too.
Know? Yeah. Yeah.
So this isn't any reason specific stuff. I apologize, but this is like a huge part of the server thing. So here's what my reason code has now become. Now I have that middleware. It serves the GraphQL API. So now my reason code is actually just translating the old style API requests into new style API requests. So
into like a GraphQL query.
Exactly right.
Okay.
So I was using the GraphQL PPX.
Right.
Which is cool, but I was running into some limitations because that's kind of built for like when you are crafting stuff by hand.
Yeah,
a client. So in this case, I am because I'm taking old requests that are coming in and like I'm parsing them and I'm getting their questions out, but like there were times when I wanted to just say like pass in this entire object as a, actually that was the main problem. So for variables in the GraphQL PPX, they want you to pass in a JavaScript object, JST of A.
Oh yeah.
So you're supposed to put in the fields and the values. In fact, it's not JST of A. They type it. They give you a type.
That's right. Because they want it to be well typed.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to do a generic, like we're just translating some query that could be any number of things, that won't work with the specific typings.
So and in this case, I do actually have types that map up, but I've written JSON decoders from the API that's coming in to decode into the correct data shape.
Gotcha.
And then I'm just going to plug that in. So I am losing a little type safety. I just started using another library that's a basic GraphQL client where it's just like you send this text string and you substitute in these variables like
okay.
Very simple client. But it's nice because I have my JSON decoders that construct the fragments that I want from the API that's coming in.
Yeah.
And then I just drop them right in as JavaScript, as like a JSON object that's serialized. I drop that right in, sends the request off. That's great. So I do lose a little bit of type safety because I have to make sure that I've decoded that the right way.
Uh-huh.
And it's possible that I've made a mistake and it fails at runtime. But I'm pretty happy with this right now. This is a pretty great arrangement. So
cool.
So Postgres is doing my heavy lifting for me. And then my APIs just sit in front and I'm using Express. And I didn't even get to this yet, but I actually wanted to talk for a second about coming up with reason-like APIs.
Oh, yeah.
For existing libraries.
Yeah.
Because the Express wrapping library does a good job of wrapping Express with its current
JavaScript design. Just exposing all of the methods.
Yeah.
Just like the JavaScript methods.
Like, this is how Express works, right?
Right.
But that wasn't... Here's the main problem I had with that. I wanted to have an experience where when I'm defining an endpoint, I could say, before I reach this endpoint, I want to authenticate the user, and I want to get their user object, the well-typed user object in scope for my endpoint. And I want to also be able to just throw in another line in there that says, by the way, also parse the body as JSON and use this decoder.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be able to, here's where it gets more complex. I don't want to just throw an error if I can't decode the body the way I want. And I also don't want to just throw an error, like an exception, if the user isn't available or is wrong. I want to return meaningful status codes. So what you end up having is middleware, but in Express, when you have middleware, you can't, like, you can attach stuff to the request context, but there's no typing there.
Right.
It's just the Wild West. So you can't like have a middleware go ahead and authenticate the user and then attach the user to the context and then have a typed context. That's just, and there's no provision for that either in the current wrapping for the Express library.
Sure. Cause that would be rather more of a layer than just a plain wrapping.
Right. And that's where we're headed. Uh-huh. So it's interesting to think that sometimes it's okay to come up with a new layer to structure the way you're interacting with a library. So
yeah. So
I wrote a new layer on top of BS Express that allows you to chain handlers, and these handlers carry a context with them.
Okay.
So I wrote a handler that checks to see if the user is there, and the thing that handler returns isn't just middleware. It's like it returns an ADT.
Okay.
A type union.
Yeah.
That says either continue onto the next middleware, onto the next handler, and pass this information along, or return with the status code.
Hmm.
So this allows me, this is kind of like a try, but it's request specific. So at any specific handler, you can say, get in the request context, do some stuff, and either continue or respond right here.
Okay.
And now I can kind of chain these along. So I've got a handler, and then I wrote another one another function that takes a parser for the body, goes ahead and parses the body, and if it doesn't match up, it returns a 400 and says, sorry, the body isn't formatted correctly. And then these are chainable such that a handler takes in the data from the previous one in line and adds new data to it and then passes it along. So that was hard to... I'm sure that didn't make any sense just listening. But the point I'm trying to make is, like, for our reason code, we can definitely take the liberty of expanding on what's already there.
Yeah.
And making some new pattern that makes sense for making it easier and leveraging types to do that.
Totally.
Because I think coming from the JavaScript world, many of us are just kind of like, we'll just use what's there. Like, I'll just use Express the Express way and do all the other hard stuff by hand. Because all this stuff I could have done by hand without this extra design pattern, but it would have been less understandable and more work, I think.
Right, and more error prone.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't have the benefit of types all along the way.
The downside is the source code for that handler stuff that I wrote is pretty hard to understand.
Okay.
So it's one of those libraries that, like, when you see it in use, you're like, oh, that's nice. But when you go to look at the actual types, you're like, whoa.
Right.
What happened here? You know, this is so hard to understand. And I had that experience in Elm. There are some of the libraries that are really nice to use, but the type signatures are just not comprehensible. I'm not sure how to solve that.
I think it's isolating complexity, right? It is this is complexity that would be just kind of splattered throughout your code, and you group it all up into one file that you can, you know, write good tests for and, you know, look over carefully, but then you don't have to think about it when you're using it in other places.
That's a great point. So you think that's okay?
Yeah.
As long as you can get the API learnable enough, right? Mm-hmm. Write good documentation enough.
Documentation and test cases.
Yeah.
To nail down the things that are hard.
Interesting point. Well, that's the update from my servers. Oh, actually, hold on. I got way off in the weeds there. But deployment.
Okay.
I started deploying code on Elastic Beanstalk with AWS. And if you remember last episode, I talked about deployment being a nightmare because you have to bundle with Webpack and et cetera, et cetera. Well, actually, in case you weren't listening last episode, the issue was you had to bundle with Webpack because the compiler being included in node modules was too big for your normal deploy. But I started deploying stuff on Elastic Beanstalk and using AWS Code Build.
Okay.
Which is really pretty straightforward to get set up to build the code before I ship it in, and realized that I think I can take Webpack out completely because I just push to my repository and Code Build will be in charge, and they have big boxes. Code Build will be in charge of pulling down the Git code. It can cache the install of BS Platform.
Oh, great.
So it's already there. It doesn't have to spend forever downloading it. It can compile all of my code there and then build the zip that it sends straight over to Elastic Beanstalk, because Elastic Beanstalk will take a zip file. So
okay. It
actually does all the build stuff, excludes the big compile. Like, I'll just go ahead and exclude the big binary files that are unnecessary, and I could ship all the artifacts that are necessary over with the zip file. So there's a nice way to deploy. I haven't done it yet, but I plan to.
Okay, and you should document that when you get it.
Yeah, great idea. So if you are wanting to do server-side node and Buckle script, there's a way to do it without having to use Webpack.
Awesome.
Okay. Whew.
That was good. So when you were talking about Postgres and all the cool things, now the way to tie Reason in is to get Reason as the language that you're writing the Postgres rules in.
Oh, that would be way cool.
That's probably way... more in the weeds than would be helpful at all. But
a major yak shave.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was looking for.
But it could be fun.
Speaking of yak shaves, I just tonight released the new VS Code plugin for Reason. Reason Language Server. I've been making a new IDE editor integration that speaks the language server protocol that lots of editors are using these days. And the big goal with it was no extra things to install. Right, previously, you had to have Merlin installed separately through Reason CLI, and that could be difficult sometimes. So one package to install and Windows support out of the box. And so you get the Reason-VS Code plugin on VS Code, and it will work Windows, Linux, Mac, right out of the box, no problem.
Amazing.
There are some bugs. I'm fixing them. If you find bugs, let me know. There's a GitHub repository where you can file issues. And especially if you want to contribute and make it better, I've already had a bunch of contributors starting in, and I've highlighted issues that are good for people that are just getting started. And I'd be happy to hold your hand to help fix those.
Awesome. And I installed it tonight.
There you go.
So thanks for releasing it.
Yeah.
So you're saying that this is kind of already at a point where it's more convenient or more helpful than the existing OCaml tools, right?
Yeah. So it has Windows support out of the box, and it doesn't require any extra setup.
Sorry, you already said those things, but I mean as far as features, where like code introspection.
Right. It has nearly all of the same features. There are some that the one has that the other doesn't have, and vice versa. I've been using it for the past several weeks as my exclusive IDE plugin.
Mind-blowingly cool. How many hours do you think you spent developing this language server?
Oh, lots.
Lots of hours.
Yeah. Probably 100. No, 50. Something like that.
That's good. That's good to hear, because I think that when people listening hear about projects like these, we only hear at the end like, hey, I did this thing. And it's like, right. Well, I should be able to pop out stuff like that too. But it's good to hear that it took you a whole lot of work to get it released, because then we get a better perspective for the effort that went into it. And
well, and even this project was building on a couple of other projects that I've been working on for the past year. And so I was able to reuse a lot of the knowledge and some of the code from previous things that we're doing, code introspection and that kind of thing.
Cool. Awesome. So are there other people that are joining in this, like, as what's the maintenance plan for this? Cause I don't know that you're going to have 100 hours more to keep merging pull requests and reviewing stuff.
There have been a couple people that are, fixing bugs and making changes. I think that in not too much more time, it will be at a place where it doesn't have to change very much.
Okay.
Right. It'll just work. When there's a new Buckle script release, there'll be a couple more features or a couple of changes that I'll have to adapt to. But I think the bulk of the work is actually done.
How interesting. So I'm curious about people who make plugins for money. And I don't think that it doesn't sound like that would be something that's interesting to you, but like JetBrains sells their IDEs and they do a great job making like massive power for code introspection and refactoring. Uh-huh. So I wonder, like, if someone approached you and said, hey, I would like to take your plugin and, add all these paid features onto it and like take it over and maintain it and make this free version the paid version, like, what would your response to them be?
That's a cool idea. There are definitely I've had a lot of ideas for cool refactoring, things that you could do that would take a lot of work to pull off. And I might get to some of them. But you know, definitely as long as, the core remains open source and so there remains a free version, I wouldn't be opposed to somebody saying, I'm going to really put a lot of effort into the refactoring experience and making that awesome.
That's interesting. I wonder at what point, like, I wonder how big the community would have to get before that would be profitable for somebody to do.
Right. That's a good question.
Lots of people have to pick it up. Cool stuff. Well, that's super exciting. I see one more thing on our list.
That's right. So we've gotten a bunch of responses to the State of Reason survey. And one of the biggest things that people are excited about is, let's get dedicated syntax so I can do async await, so I don't have to keep nesting promises and doing all this stuff. And we're finally getting an async await syntax.
And this isn't just a PPX.
Right. This will be first class citizen. And for those of you that like category theory, it is a generalized monad syntax. So it'll be, you can use it for options and results and promises. And, you know, if you're doing LWT async, you can use it for that. But it's basically a way to have, you know, the same as async await in JavaScript. Instead of nesting promises, it'll all be inline. And it's a new way to declare a let variable, where you're saying, you know, let async x equals y, and x will be bound to the result of y once it's been resolved.
So let's get in the weeds.
Okay.
So weed warning for anyone who's listening, just go ahead and skip if you're not a weed person. But I'm guessing if you're listening, you're probably okay with weeds because it's kind
of, if you've made it this far, this is the weed episode.
So here we go with the weeds. Generalized bind syntax.
Yeah.
Do you have to define like what, like how would you, for example, say, okay, now I'm working with an option. Like,
right.
You'd have to know that the thing you're using it on implements monad, right?
So it is, it's more general than monad, interestingly.
Okay.
So you, there are some interesting things that you could do. You could implement, let guard, using this, for, so if you've used Swift or, Rust, there's a way to do an early return, and you could implement early return using this syntax. Basically, all it's if you're familiar with continuation passing style, where instead of having local scope, the way to declare a variable is to call up, you know, make a new function and then call it with the value.
Yeah.
And then the parameter of the function is your new variable. So anything where you, you know, can pass a value to a function and then a callback to the function that will get called somehow, you can use it with the syntax.
No way.
So with option, if you're like, I have all these options, for example, if I'm doing GraphQL and there are a bunch of optional things and I'm getting into callback hell or like, you know, the arrow pattern, you can have an option module that says, okay, when you do let, I'm going to do a switch on the value. And if it's none, I'll just return none. Otherwise I'll call the callback function with the contents of the option.
Okay. So anything, so there does have to be a special like function available on the module that you're using.
So yeah, we haven't specified any built-in modules yet.
Okay.
This is just adding the syntax.
I see.
And so you can make a module that will do option. You can make a module that will promise. And then we'll probably bake into Belt or somewhere.
A bunch of those.
You know, here are the most common that we found to be so useful.
Do you have to bring them into scope, or is this kind of an implicit thing where the syntax looks for the compatible function and calls it for you?
It follows scoping rules. So if you do let dot async x equals y, it'll look for a module called async. If you do let dot...
A module called async?
A module called async that has a let underscore function in it, and it'll call async dot let.
Oh, so would you do let dot uppercase async?
Yeah.
So, okay, so like if I made a function, if I made a module called foo.
Yes.
Just pulled that one out of the air. If I made a module called foo and I had some kind of continuation passing pattern in here, I would say let dot foo.
Mm-hmm.
And then inside of foo, I would define a function called let underscore.
Yep.
And that would take...
It would take a value and a function.
And it would do the continuation. So in the case of promise, it would be let dot promise, or would it be let dot js dot promise? Or like let dot belt dot promise?
I'd probably call the module await. So I can do let dot await and it looks like JavaScript await.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
And then like for inside an option, the await module, I'd do let underscore equals promise dot then.
Okay.
And there's an and underscore, because if you're defining it's multiple things, for example, the promise dot all, you could do let dot await x equals y and dot await z equals a.
All right. Yeah.
And so then you can do a promise dot all and have them both execute concurrently.
Whoa. My mind just blew up. Whoa. Okay.
And so that's where the monad, it's the monad. I forget what the name of the operation is, but joining two things together.
So what if you have like a list of promises and you want to do promise dot all on all of them? Would you do?
You'd probably just do promise dot all on the list. I don't think there's any benefit for having a syntax that would break apart your list or do weird things like that.
Well, but if you awaited it, you would just return it. You'd end up with a list of results.
That's right.
Right. So what you could do is you could make a module called like await all or something, and it takes in a list, right?
Yeah.
A list of promises.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that generic.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really interesting. So when do we expect to see it?
You know, it'll probably get merged in the next little while, and then the next reason release will have it.
Okay. So, I mean, like, are we thinking like, oh yeah, maybe we could probably get this in the next like 8 months. How often is it released?
I'd be surprised if it took more than a couple more weeks to get merged.
Wow.
And then there will be this period of time where we're experimenting, you know, what does it look like to use this? We were careful in the proposal to make it as minimal a change as possible. Because there are some things like, well, what if we, it'd be nice to actually have a lowercase await. It's weird to do let dot capital await. And later on we could say, yeah, we'll add that sugar to auto capitalize the module name.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what if it gets annoying to keep typing it out? Is there a way to do a local open and just have that automatically apply to all lets? Like that, there are a couple of different ideas, where once we start using the syntax, we might say, okay, here are the things that are annoying.
So what about, how do you feel about the balance between language complexity and verbosity here? Cause like Scala is a cool language, but there's a whole lot of sugar.
Yeah.
And it's pretty rough when you're just coming into the language. Arguably that's a front loaded cost. Right. Uh-huh. And so once I learned some of that stuff in Scala, I was fine and I could understand it after, but certainly coming into Scala, I was like, there are so many cases where it's like, oh, if you just have no arguments, you can leave this off. And if you wanted to just do this, you can leave that off and then leave this in there. And it's just like, how do I even read this stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Like Elm takes kind of the opposite approach where it's like, there's no sugar.
Right.
Like this is just bran, you know?
Straight, yeah.
And so I feel like reason's in the middle right now.
Uh-huh.
I kind of did my own sugar by using Haskellish operators for promise
right.
stuff. And that's been okay. And I'm excited for the syntax, but I'm also wondering, do you think it significantly complicates the language?
I think it it comes from seeing people using Haskellish operators, and I think this will be easier to understand.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's let.await, and you can command-click await, and it'll take you to the module definition, and you can see exactly what happens.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
So I think this is actually less magic than what people are forced to do currently. And I like that about it.
And to make it more readable too.
And also, async await is a pattern that a bunch of other languages have already implemented and had lots of success with. And so I think looking to that and saying, okay, this is a standard practice thing that has made all these languages better. Let's do that.
And then, I was going to ask about error handling, but it's just going to be the same. I mean,
yeah.
And you can implement this for any data type you want, right. Including tries or no, they're not called tries.
Results.
Yep. Yeah. Wow.
Yep. And so I've been experimenting with this syntax just implemented as a PPX in my Reason language server.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, what does it look like to do this kind of transform? Not with a specialized syntax for it, but just with this, AST plugin. And it's made everything so much more readable.
Cool.
And you know, when people come in to try and contribute to the code, the places where I've started using that, it's easy to understand. The places where I'm still using the Haskell like infix operators, it's like I don't even know what's going on.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited. I can't wait to see that come out.
Yeah. You'll have to await that.
Oh, you just did that.
Okay. Well, that's our last thing, I think.
That's a wrap.
Unless there's anything else, please go out. If you haven't yet, fill out the State of Reason survey. We'd love to get your feedback on the community and the language and anything else.
I don't remember if our episodes are normally half an hour, but if they are, then you just got a double dose.
That's right.
Because it's an hour episode and it's time to go to bed.
Yep. We'll be getting some more interviews on here in the next little bit. So look forward to that. And see you next time.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody. Bye.